Hello and welcome to the BOAG Award Show, the longest running web design podcast where we look at user experience design, conversion rate optimization, and working in the web. On this week's show, we're going to look beyond usability, go deeper into user research, and handle negative feedback sensitively, because I'm well known for my sensitivity.
Yeah, I've got some interesting notes on that section. No, not really.
Hello, Marcus. How are you doing, mate?
I'm fine. You're looking very, very summery. I think it'd be the right way to describe it. You're looking all sort of tanned and summer shirt.
Well, the weather hasn't been amazing. So for those people who don't know, I own an RV out here in the States. And so every few months we come back here and we travel around for a few months while I work at the same time. I get faster internet over here than I do in my own house because of Starlink, although I'm not very pleased.
So you can watch more films more reliably and things like that.
You know, on LinkedIn, this is relevant, right?
Yeah.
So I've abandoned all social networks except for LinkedIn now. So I don't post to Twitter, I don't post to Facebook or any of the others, just LinkedIn. And I'm really pleased I've made the move, because it means I can write more in detailed stuff and you're not kind of limited to that 250 characters or whatever. But one of the things that LinkedIn does is you can add these frames on top of your profile picture that says things like hiring or open to work or stuff like that. And I didn't really feel that these fully expressed where I am in my career. So I made one that said ready to retire and put that in instead. Yeah.
God, I am.
Unfortunately, unfortunately, then everybody thought I was actually retiring. And it's like, no, I still need to make money for 12 years. Please don't stop talking to me.
Isn't it?
Damn it.
Yes. In exactly the same boat. Yeah. Where are you going in America this time, Paul? So people can follow you.
So, yeah, just kind of pottering around Nevada and Arizona and places like that, really. Going to all the national parks and just kind of poodle about, see how it goes. We're doing a few more kind of experience-y stuff. Normally, we just do, like, looking at pretty nature.
Cool.
But this time, my wife has persuaded me to do an overnight whitewater rafting trip down the Grand Canyon. Which I am not sure whether I think is a good idea or not. I like the idea in theory, but I'm not so sure whether I would like the practicalities of it. We shall see.
I think I would like that, but still,
yeah,
exciting.
It'd be fun.
Yeah. But various updates. I've got the wedding saga to update you on, Paul.
Headscape work saga.
And firstly, how's your diet going, Paul? We talked about your intolerances last week.
Yes.
Now you're in America.
It's going really well.
Is it?
As you can imagine. Yeah. But I'm having a light week till we get into the RV where we control things, you know.
So you're on a holiday in all respects. Yeah, that's nice. How lovely, Paul.
Look, anyway,
tell me about what's wrong with you? Oh, you're on holiday.
I'm happy. Yeah. That's what it is.
Yeah, so with
tell me about the wedding.
The wedding, right, yeah. So I was moaning last time, if you remember, about it being like herding cats and a pain in the ass. So we just said, sod it. Not sod it, get married. We are going to get married, but not till next year when we originally planned it, because we'd sort of got this date, we could do it this year. And then we realised that costs were spiraling like mental, and it wasn't what we wanted. Yeah. And it was like, why are we doing this? So it was like this massive relief. We said, and then we booked another holiday. So we're going on holiday in 2 weeks' time.
Much better. That's much better.
So I'm quite happy too. Italy to go skiing again.
This place that we're staying just outside of Vegas is Italy styled. So it's supposed to feel like Italy.
Oh.
It doesn't feel like Italy at all. But they seem to like it. So.
Okay.
So this work thing with Headscape.
Well,
whether you've got enough work. Yeah.
Well, yeah, we're talking about plenty at the moment. But no, I did the Headscape advert, if you remember, so beautifully on the last episode, basically saying that we didn't have any opportunities. We've got a couple now, so that's interesting. Things to chase after, but it's still a bit thin on the ground. So Headscape, come to us.
Well, of course, that last episode hasn't gone out yet.
I know.
So when that goes out, obviously...
Swamp.
Yeah. We will. You'll just be overwhelmed. It'll probably come out while you're away in Italy.
Yeah.
And you'll get all these leads through, and then people get stroppy because you don't reply.
No, it won't, because and Chris will deal with it.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, although he really is genuinely retiring soon. Hate him.
Bastard.
That'll be me we getting like sadder and sadder as the year goes on.
Anyway, let's talk about some apps. So, couple of things. You know what? I'm supposed to be on holiday. I'm so shit at holiday. For a start, I'm recording this, which I guess you could argue is work, but that's a bit probably stretching a point a bit. But also, I've been playing because I've been bored, and I've been playing with various tools. And so I've been playing with all of these. Have you seen these AI designer tools that exist today? So they like design and code up entire websites.
I know of them, Paul, I actually wrote, I'm interested in this to see how well you got on. Because I've not tried anything. I'd be interested to know if a complete sort of non-developer like me, how I would manage. I'd be interested to know. Not that I want to build apps or websites, just interested. Tell us all about it, Paul.
Yeah. So I tried four different products. I tried UX Pilot, V0, Polymet, and Lovable, right? And they're all the darlings of the investor world at the moment, and people are just dumping money into them. I was a bit underwhelmed, if I'm honest. They would take a lot of finagling to get something decent out of them.
Right.
It's not simply a matter of kind of putting, you know, saying I want a so-and-so website and it churns out, you know, this wonderful website by any means. Oftentimes, you know, it would return things where text was completely unreadable because it was white text against a white background and stupid things like that that you would have thought would have been relatively easy to have avoided. Copy was fairly bland and mediocre. Code I didn't really look at a lot, but you know, one website I tried to build with one of the tools, it just returned the HTML and just didn't give me the CSS at all. So it's a little bit disappointing.
Just to go back on that point, I mean, if I was a non-developer, and I assume you use kind of prompts like with AI generally, you to make these things appear. If I just got a load of HTML, I'd be thinking, well, this is crap. How much do these things cost?
They're not massively expensive. They're within, you know, I can't remember the exact prices because they all varied all over the place, and some of them hid their prices and that kind of thing. But it's a hell of a lot cheaper. You know, you're talking someone like you could get it for a few months. You know, it's within those kinds. It's not like hiring a professional designer or anything like that. I just expected a little bit more from it. I mean, I didn't expect it to be amazing. And I'm not just saying this because, you know, it's threatening my job. I mean, it's not going to threaten my job and the kind of thing that I'm doing, even if it did a great job. But like, I was giving it a decent prompt as well. You know, I actually took a massive report I wrote for one of my clients where I recommended what they did with their website. I then took that across into ChatGPT and I said, turn this into a good prompt that I can put into, you know, one of these designer tools. And it kind of summarized everything that was in the report. So I pulled all of that in. I gave it a screenshot of the existing website. So I really tried to make it work. And I could have kept iterating and doing prompt after prompt after prompt to get it there, I suspect. But it's not easy with a lot of these tools to change particular parts of the page. Some of them allow you to do it. I mean, I didn't pay any money. There was, I think it was Polymet that allows you to say, fix this part of the page. Don't change this bit and change this bit.
Okay.
So that enabled a bit more of that. But it was a bit shit, basically. It was a bit of a shit experience. And I think they're a long way from even being useful for prototyping, let alone actual sites. I see a lot of entrepreneurs getting very excited about it. And I watched one guy use it. And the thing that came across to me, he was obviously an entrepreneur and not somebody experienced in building websites. And he sounded just like we have to put up with designers, as designers, you know, when clients come to us and ask for some vague idea. And then he actually wrote at one point, "I'm actually really disappointed with the outcome of this." And I thought, you sound like you're talking to a designer here. And of course, he wasn't getting anything that he wanted whatsoever, because he couldn't articulate it well.
Yeah.
But even me, as somebody who I hope articulates things quite well from a design perspective, couldn't really get anything from it. So,
interesting.
My advice to everybody listening to this is not yet. Just don't worry about them too much at the moment. There are, of course, the worst they're ever going to be. They're only going to get better from now.
Yeah.
So I would circle back around and have another look in, say, a year or something like that. Cool. So, yeah, that's where I got to with that. The other app of the week that I wanted to mention, well, it isn't really an app. It's something that's been around for a while, but I've only just found a use case or a new use case for it. I've used it in different ways before, and that's the deep research that most of these AI models now offer. So my personal favorite for this kind of thing is Perplexity, but ChatGPT offers it, Google Gemini offers it, it all do really now. And it's this idea of deep research.
What does that mean, Uncle Paul?
It means that it goes away and...
as a little think.
As a little think, yeah.
Okay.
And it looks at a lot more sources, okay? So to give you an example, I've used it in lots of different ways, but the one way that I've started to use it that I absolutely friggin' love is for user research, online user research, right? So you know when you don't actually have the time or the resources to do proper user research, it happens. It shouldn't happen, but it happens. So what I had a project like this, and I actually had done a survey and I was running a survey and I'd do some user interviews, but I thought, oh well, I'll just give it a go and see what happens. So I told Perplexity, you know, this is the client, this is what we're trying to achieve. I'd like you to go away and do some user research. I'm trying to understand what users' sentiments are around this product that I was trying to promote, what users like about, it was insurance I was working on. So what, you know, what elements of insurance do they like? What do they dislike? What questions do they have? What objections stop them going with certain companies? What motivates them, right? And I said, go away and find that out for me. And it went away and it looked through social media and any mention of insurance through social media. It looked through review site like Trustpilot. It looked at online forums like Money Supermarket or Money Expert or, you know, all of these kinds of things. Scoured the web and came back with this really comprehensive report in terms of what users want or don't want from an insurance provider. Mm. And it was just invaluable in terms of stuff. And I could even go, like, for example, the other thing, because this was a conversion rate optimization job, basically, to make their pages more, you know, higher converting. And so I followed up and said, hey, look, you know, you've identified these three things that people really want from an insurance company. Now go away and find me three testimonials that people have posted on something like Trustpilot that back up those three different things, and then I can put those into the web page. And it was just bloody brilliant in terms of, you know, finding out really useful stuff about users with nearly zero effort on my part. It takes about half an hour for it to go away and do all this research, but totally worth it, except for the massive environmental impact, of course.
Yeah, and there's always that underlying, do I really trust it? I think I do, but yes.
Yeah. Well, this is where deep research is slightly different from the normal bullshit that AI can make up sometimes. Yeah, yeah. So whenever it makes a statement, it gives you a link and you can click through and see the source of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Right?
Yeah.
So you know, I didn't do it with every single link, but I do it with a sample just to be a little bit more confident in what it's saying before I start quoting it back to clients and stuff like that. So, yeah,
that does
really
sound
good,
really,
really, really.
genuinely useful.
So that's that.
What's next?
Right. What are we next? Yes. Oh, yes. Our topic for today, which is about usability. This one was born out of the fact that I'm in Vegas.
Okay. Right.
So it was when we first arrived, we spent a couple of nights in the Excalibur Hotel on the Strip. I don't know whether you know it. The one that looks like a medieval castle, or at least what Americans think a medieval castle should look like a fairy castle, really. And it was just because it was cheap and it was really near the airport. And so before we came out here, we wanted to stay somewhere. So I hate those kinds of hotels, to be honest, because you never know what time of day it is because there's no windows and that.
Yeah.
But anyway, and you have to walk through the casino to get to your rooms. Now, I'm not a gambler at all. Yeah, of course. But I'm not a gambler at all. It just doesn't appeal to me. But you walk through this huge bank of slot machines. Every imaginable type of slot machine that you can ever think of. You know, Game of Thrones slot machines, the Cardassian slot machines.
Yeah.
And they're all basically the same, but they've got these different, you know, things to them. And it got me thinking about how crass they all are and about how, you know, stupid they are. And then I kind of caught myself a little bit and thought, what would happen if a user experience designer, or even a product designer, not that there's much difference in my opinion between the two, but that's a whole nother conversation, went and designed a slot machine and how shit it would be, right? Because we're so obsessed with the usability, right? And removing friction points and all of that kind of stuff. We would ruin a slot machine, right? Because we'd go, well, we don't need all those flashing lights. They're just a distraction, right? All we need is the ability for somebody to you know, get the dials moving, you know, and the reels moving. Okay, so we can simplify the interface. Actually, now I think about it, there's no actual gear. You know, those reels don't actually mean anything, right? So we could just there could be a button that someone presses, and then it'll say win or lose on it, and that'd be it. That'd be great. Do you know what? What would be even better is, why are they pressing a button? When they put the money in, it could just say lose on the screen and you'd be done, right? And that's it.
Genius,
it was
Paul.
A stupid
genius.
Thing. I know, I'm a genius. I've just improved user experience massively. But what it got me, I guess all of this is to say that it got me down this rabbit hole of that I think oftentimes as UX designers and as product designers, we focus really heavily on usability. And I think we prioritize usability over everything else. Andy Clark should be here, really, because this is a topic that he rants about regularly.
Me too.
And how you can actually end up... Yeah, you have. You can end up with a very sterile and forgettable experience. Mm. And for me, this is where I think we need to look outside of our own discipline for inspiration in this. So, you know, slot machine designers, I actually then started, because I'm bored and on holiday, I started looking up YouTube videos about what's involved in designing a slot machine. And it's fascinating. It's really, really interesting, all the psychology behind it. And then also Andy always looks at print design, which often is more creative and has got these creative elements involved in it. And also the other one, which I guess, again, this is another thing about being in America, is they've got a very customer service culture. And so, you know, looking at customer experience and there is so much more than just usability, you know, like, for example, when you go into a restaurant. You know, a restaurant experience isn't just great because ordering is easy, right? And the food is nutritious. You know, there's the ambiance, there's the service, there's how the experience feels. And UX should be more like that And I know I'm preaching to the choir, and a lot of people listening to this will already be of that mindset. But I do feel like there's a generation of maybe slightly more junior designers that have come out of these boot camps that exist, these UX boot camps, that focus so much on process and usability and testing and research. But often that testing and research doesn't consider that emotional experience, but it's just looking at the usability experience. So, I mean, and these two interlink as well, because like, if you take something like going on a holiday, I wonder why I picked that as an analogy, but you know, that's a real roller coaster of emotions where, the way you're feeling has a direct impact on your experience and even on the usability. So, you know, to begin with, you're really excited. Where should we go? What should we do with our holiday? And then you get a bit more nervous when it comes to, well, you know, do we go to this hotel or this hotel? Which is best? Then we really have to start like booking and putting our money where our mouth is. And that kind of is the horrible bit that we don't like. And then we start to get excited again about looking forward to going on holiday. And then just before we fly, we start worrying about if we got remembered all the things we need. And so it's this up and down. And from a kind of cognitive load perspective, we know that our emotional state has a direct impact on how easy and usable things are and how pleasurable they are as well. So that's why you wake up some mornings, you wake up in a bad mood and the entire day goes to shit, because you wake up in a bad mood, which pushes your cognitive load up, which means everything seems to be harder and more difficult to do, which puts you in an even worse mood and you get caught in this kind of loop. So all of this is to say that I think we need to be testing a lot more than just usability, and that we need to have metrics as user experience professionals that are more than just usability metrics. So when we're carrying out testing on the design, there are well-known ones that marketers use already, like the NPS score, the Net Promoter Score. How likely is somebody to recommend your product to somebody else? That's a really good one. There's also a lot of metrics that are used in the customer service industry, you know, where you go like through airport security. Sorry, you could tell what's at the top of my mind at the moment. When you go through airport security, you come out the other end, they have those three buttons. How was your experience today? Smiley face, neutral face, unhappy face. And all of that helps to build up a picture of where people are. And then going back to what we were talking about earlier with that deep research and online sentiment, you know, how are people responding online? But one of my favorites is the semantic differential survey, right? Which is a really pretentious name for something I know you're already familiar with, Marcus, because we used to do it together. And it's the idea that when you produce a design or an interaction, you put it in front of users and you give them a cloud of words to describe what the design is. Is it friendly? Is it professional? Is it frustrating? Is it pleasurable? You know, all of these different kinds of words. And that can give you an idea of how your design is feeling rather than just how it's working. So, yeah. Usability by itself, I don't think is enough. I think we need a better focus on things like the emotions we're invoking, because those are the things that build loyalty, that create lasting impressions, that encourage word of mouth recommendation and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but I know I'm talking to the, you're singing to the choir, aren't I, with you?
Preaching to the choir, absolutely. Yeah. There's this kind of, I think particularly amongst sort of back-end stuff in particular, where it's form over function and it's all about function, form doesn't matter. And I'm of the feeling that it's form and function. Both are really important. Yes, some people. So there are some people in the world that really don't care about form, but most people do, I would argue. Otherwise, Apple wouldn't have the huge market share that they've got for their gorgeous pieces of tech that are also very easy to use. It's form and function. That's the point. Mm. Super basic kind of utilitarian design is fine for a very small amount of things, but the vast majority requires a lot more than that, which you've just been saying, Paul.
And I think as well, there's part of the problem is that we don't, that if you ask somebody, do they care about how something looks or something feels, they'll say, oh, no, I just want to get it done as soon as possible. But there's a huge discrepancy between what people say and what the reality of their experience is.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you ask somebody how they make a decision between buying two products, they'll say they weigh up the pros and the cons and all of that. And that's absolute bollocks.
They just
know that.
Ooh, shiny is what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, I think you raise a really good point in terms of like back-end systems. So a lot of people here these days are building out products that are used as part of somebody's workflow, you know, either internally within an organization or as a SaaS project product. And I think that is partly what's led to this obsession with usability, that there is this perception that how people feel about the design isn't really important in a situation like that.
Yeah.
It's how usable, how quickly they can complete tasks.
Which is not true.
But no, it's not. Because there is a direct correlation between how we feel about something and how easy we perceive it to be to use. And that's the ridiculous thing.
Yeah.
You know? And then MailChimp used to be a great example of this. They're not anymore because Aaron Walters, who was the guy that originally built all this up, moved on to other things. But, you know, they were an amazing product in terms of how they brought these moments of delight into the interface, that lifted you and made you feel like this wasn't just another boring corporate piece of software.
Yeah.
You know, so they had this character called Freddy, who was like a chimpanzee, and that was their mascot and their logo and stuff like that. And Freddy would pop up in all kinds of little places in the interface, you know?
Yeah.
Like, for example, when you were previewing your email, it had like a ruler along the top to show how many pixels wide your preview was. And Freddy would point along the ruler, his arm outstretched. And the wider you made it, the longer his arm got. And eventually his arm popped off if you extended it too far. You know, absolutely pointless. Except those kinds of things do influence us at a subconscious level. Mm. But we underestimate that, you know?
I think so too.
This is where Rory Sutherland, that we talked about a few episodes, comes in. You know, he talks a lot about this kind of stuff. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about what I have been reading this week. Couple of good articles, actually.
Okay.
I read some good stuff that I really quite enjoyed this week. The first was The Path to Design Leadership, which was is written by someone called Hang Lee, who used to lead teams at Dropbox, amongst others. And it's a really good article for kind of understanding what design leadership really is all about. I'll put the links in the show notes to this. This is episode 17, so it'll be boag.world/17017. And it's a really good article. I really recommend you check it out. It talks a lot about, you know, what design leadership is, which I think is a long way from what many design leaders do. I think many design leaders really are just senior designers rather than actually leaders of design, that ultimately they're still implementing other people's strategies and other people's directions, while a true design leader, it should be guiding the company's strategy, as well as doing things like ensuring high quality design work and managing and developing the design team. But another thing that the author of this article said, which I really believe in, which is that it's also about bringing about organizational change. It's about helping the company to become more user-centric, more design-centric in its thinking. And then the article goes on to talk about how to carve out your own path as a design leader. And it was, and what I loved, I'm so biased. What I loved about this article is it completely reflects everything I say in my workshop on design leadership. So obviously,
you want to know what my notes say on this one, Paul? Do you want to know what my notes say? It's the same old bollocks you keep spouting.
Thanks, Marcus.
Anytime.
That's really encouraging.
Anytime.
Yeah.
It's all
I'm
wise
really glad.
Words. Wise words. But yeah. I did think, this is what Paul says. This. Oh, right.
Well, that's why I liked the article.
Of course, obviously, yeah.
So it talks about in the article about understanding the company's pressing problems. What is it that the company is struggling with? Or what does it want to achieve? And then your job is to look at how design can help to solve those problems and then to win over other people and bring them in line with your vision of how design can help address those problems. And that really is design leadership in a nutshell, as far as I'm concerned. Mm. So it's a really good article. Definitely check it out. It's called The Path to Design Leadership. It was written by Hang Lee. So I'm sure you can just Google it if you forget the URL, which is boag.world/017. The second article was on product waste. I found this one a really good way of framing the value of design and design leadership. And so the basic premise of the article is that product waste, it comes about because you end up building the wrong thing that won't deliver positive business outcomes, often because it doesn't actually meet real user needs. And I think this is a massive, massive problem in organizations. The number of times either I see myself or those that I mentor and coach are being asked to build something that should never be being built. Not that the whole idea is fundamentally wrong. Often there's a nugget of something in there, but it's shaped just in completely the wrong way by stakeholders rather than by real business needs or user needs. And the author in this article, I mean, where they find this particular number, I suspect they just pulled it out of their ass, but they estimate that about 50% of product effort results in waste, costing companies millions annually. I don't know whether that's true or not. It doesn't feel wrong, if I'm honest with you. I don't know what you think.
Good number, yeah.
It's a good number,
Don't think I had slightly kind of negative response to this. I think, well, that's just humans. That's people, executives, managers, thinking that their idea is the right idea and we're going to run with this is never going to go away, ever, ever.
No.
I think it's possibly because executives are older, more senior people who've got a lot of general responsibility, but they've got a dangerous amount of specific knowledge in certain areas, like, say, product design. So they go in going, I know this and I know that. And I don't know what you do about that, really, because it's probably the same. I imagine people who build offices or... I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
It'll be the same problem. Thing. Yeah, yeah. Oh, so-and-so said we've got to do it like this, and they haven't got a clue, you know. I just think it's a thing.
What, do you just give up then?
No.
Do you know what I mean?
You hire the likes of Paul Boag and Headscape to come in and deal with these
Marcus,
executives.
Marcus, that can't be your answer to everything.
if you're struggling with that, if you're not, then you listen to Paul Boag's wise words about design leadership and you get on with it and make these things happen. But what my point is, I think it's human nature when you're in a position of power to want to put your oar in, even if you say you don't. I've been in position with, you know, bosses we've worked with in the past. Well, I'm just going to hand it over to you guys. You're the experts and we're paying you a lot of money. So, you know, I'll just sit back and they never do. Well, not never do is too
but
strong.
Then, but what I totally agree with that. And I do think you two to some degree need to come to peace with that, that is the reality. And I come across a lot of designers that burn themselves out or get massively frustrated and feel belittled because people are not taking their advice and not listening to them.
Yeah.
It's something that I fight with a lot when I mentor people, of saying, look, your job is to give your advice, right? And to articulate that as well as you possibly can. But at the end of the day, if someone chooses to ignore your advice, that is their choice because they are more senior within the organization. That is their right that comes with seniority. And you need to be able to let go of that, you know, that, and say, okay, fair enough. I've said my piece.
Yeah.
But what I liked about this article wasn't so much, you know, he goes on to say things like, if we could reduce waste by 25%, lead to a significant reinvestment in opportunities that deliver better business results. That then goes back to what you're saying, well, that's not going to happen. So why are you saying things like that? But what I particularly liked about this article was that the way it was framing it, right, that it was framing that we should do our due diligence to reduce product waste, right? So that's quite a hard argument for people to say, no, I don't care about waste. Yeah. So we're just going to do it. Equally, it's quite a hard argument to say, I don't think we need to do due diligence, because that just sounds irresponsible, right? So instead of us going in and saying things like, we need to do a discovery phase, right? Which people can go, oh, well, we know what users want anyway, so let's go ahead. If you go in and say, we need to do our due diligence so that we avoid product waste, that's a much harder argument for someone to dismiss, right? And that's why I talked about the acronym that you laughed at when I talked about SUPER?
Yes.
The Strategic User Driven Project Assessment. I'm still not letting go of that.
I thought that one had gone, but there you go.
No, I'm not letting go of it. Nobody's ever bought it from me, but I love the acronym.
Okay.
It basically is a discovery phase by another name, but what it's doing is it's framing it in terms of reducing risk.
Yeah.
And this is talking about reducing waste. And both of those are much stronger business arguments than we need to find out a bit more about users. So the moral of the story here is watch your language, really. And, you know, and make sure that you're presenting these things in the right way.
Cool.
So that's that. And last thing, listener question. So this is another one from the Agency Academy, which is that group I run for freelancers and agency owners, where we meet up once a week and we talk about whatever we're currently struggling with and the experience of running an agency. And we've also got a Slack channel where we chat a lot about this kind of stuff. Again, you can find a link to that in the show notes if you want to, or just drop me an email to paul@barwickworld.com. But the reason I like using listener questions from this is because a lot of the content that we talk about in this show really is aimed at people that are in part of in-house teams, and it's nice to do a little bit for agency owners and freelancers as well. Obviously Marcus would have us dump this section because agency owners and freelancers are his competition, and he they're not going to hire him, and so he really doesn't care about any of them because he's incredibly selfish like that.
So I wasn't listening, sorry. What's the question,
right,
Paul?
What's the question? Let's get to the point. This actually is interesting because this one does apply to in-house teams as well. How can I provide feedback on site improvements when the person that created what I'm feeding back on is sitting in the room? And how do I do that without causing offense? I thought that was a really good question. That was from Paul Edwards. What was your thoughts on that one, Marcus? Because you have to do that. You have to go in and there's the developer sitting in the corner, you know?
Quite rare, but he'd definitely been here before. I would say that we've been on the other end of this before, and it's not nice. So, you know, no. I've been in that seat, and it, so it means that we understand. And no doubt we're going to make some points here that you might want to defend. But things like low budgets, difficult stakeholders, changing trends, changing practices, all of that kind of stuff, they're a thing that that have always been there all the way through development of websites and products and things like that. So we understand that it will be one of those things that's the reason why things are the way they are. So I would basically just say we're not here to criticise. We're here to improve things together, man, yeah. Or whatever. And then finish it off with, so stop whining. No. Yeah, that's basically try and make them say, all of that is to say, look, you know, we're in the same boat here. We do what you do. That's it, really.
I mean, I always start in the same way, really, is I acknowledge the challenge, right? That, you know, I'm gonna have to point out some things that need improving, but you know, I've sat in your position and it sucks, know? And the second one is I always emphasize right at the beginning that every website is a series of compromises. And you know, okay, you might be ultimately responsible for the website, but I bet you it's not what you would think. It's not your ideal vision, you know? And that, you know, it will be a compromises between legal department, tech stack, you know, senior stakeholders swooping and pooping and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I, you know, if people do get defensive, I always kind of listen to what they've got to say and basically repeat it back to them saying, yeah, of course you were working within time constraints or budget, or you know, acknowledge that what they're saying and reinforce them and say, look, that's a perfectly justifiable position. And I always start as well by trying to praise the things that are working well about the site and keep the focus shifted really onto the future, not what went wrong, but how to improve it moving forward.
Yep.
And, you know, if all else fails, I tend to use a bit of humor and self-deprecating about the experience. I mean, you've got to be a little bit careful there because, you know, some people don't have my sense of humor. but if you feel it's going well, you know, you can make a bit of a joke about it. I mean, I put in the shouts, well, this website's a bit of a shit show. Who is responsible for that rubbish then? But probably don't want to
maybe
say that.
A bit too
cases.
Strong.
Bit much.
Yeah.
Bit
just,
too much.
Just a little bit there.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But you can have a bit of fun
silence
with it.
Afterwards.
Yeah. 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 It's the kind of thing I would do as well, isn't it? You could imagine me doing something like that.
Yep.
All right. Well, hopefully, Paul, that advice is useful. I mean, we covered a lot of this actually in the Slack channel, but hopefully it's useful to other people as well if they find themselves in that position. It basically comes down to acknowledge that they won't be responsible for everything shit on the site and that getting feedback about your website is always shit and horrible, and just be sympathetic and empathetic.
Yes.
Go on then, Marcus. What joke do you have for us this time?
I realise that I didn't write down who sent this joke in, but I think it was a Daryl Snow one because he does the majority. But anyway, this I think you're going to love this one, Paul.
Oh, is it one of those really bad puns that I like so much?
Right. So, why are mountains funny?
Why are mountains funny?
They're hill areas. Hilarious. Hilarious. Hilarious.
Yeah.
Hill areas.
Hilarious. Yeah. It doesn't help that you stumble over the punchline, but that's okay.
I've said it four or five times. So I'll just edit all the other ones out.
Yeah. Yeah. Just keep going until you get the right one. So, all right. Well, I hope there was some stuff useful in this week's show and that you're feeling a bit more encouraged, especially around kind of making the case for more creative and a more emotionally engaging work. And obviously, if you've got questions that you want us to cover on the show, drop me an email to paul@boagworld.com or send an email to Marcus if you've got jokes or want to hire Headscape, one of those two very different things. You can send them to marcus.lillington@headscape.co.uk. think that's it, isn't it, Marcus?
Yep. I think we're done.
All right.
Have a good holiday, Paul.
I will do. Bye.
Bye.